Welcome back to the Just Space podcast, where we elevate collective voices and experiences to co-produce spaces that reflect inclusive and just values. We're your co-hosts, Amal Barre, Eka Permanasari, and Dion Nostakasari. And after a brief hiatus, we're thrilled to reconnect with you all and kick off the next chapter of this podcasting journey.
In this relaunch episode, we reflect on where we've been and where we're heading. First, we express our gratitude to our loyal listeners for your continued support and welcome those joining us for the first time. The podcast originally launched in the summer of 2023, and while time has passed, the mission remains the same: to create a space for meaningful conversations that center traditionally underrepresented voices in the co-production of knowledge and the built environment.
We'll share personal updates and growth since our last episode, from Amal's work on the Walking in Place film project and the third year of grad school, to Dian's reflections on global trauma and environmental justice, and my ongoing work in resilient climate and environmental futures. Our ongoing commitment to collective sense-making have been shaped by the global challenges of displacement, climate change, and systemic inequality that continue to fuel our work.
As we look ahead, we're excited about the evolving landscape of our research and practice. From imagining the future of affordable housing and urban development to exploring ecological grief and memory preservation, we're continuing to bridge the personal and professional to rethink how we engage with these complex issues. We're also opening up the space to explore new methodologies such as storytelling and film as tools to amplify underestimated voices and strengthen community advocacy.
So in this episode, we'll touch on what's next for the podcast, including upcoming themes and guests. We'll reach out to a range of guests from local advocates, public health leaders, and residents and storytellers to dive deeper into issues like housing access, social determinants of health, tenant rights, and infrastructural justice. Key topics aligning with our commitment to fostering spaces where everyone can thrive. Join us as we embark on this new season of the Just Space podcast. We're excited to reconnect, reimagine, and co-create new possibilities for our communities with you. So I guess the first question, we kind of started to wanting to ask each other questions around what has influenced us, particularly what are recent events or conversations that have informed or reshaped our work. Why don't you go first, Amal?
Yeah, so I've been heavily impacted by the conversations that we've had with previous podcast guests over the last year. And for the last few months, I've been thinking a lot about my personal journey in terms of the places where I have lived, the communities that I have had the opportunity to work alongside, and taking some time to just personally reflect on how my own personal past and educational journey has influenced my approach to my work and also my current research activities. For years now, one of my main goals has been to bridge the different worlds I inhabit. For context, I'm an immigrant child born in Somalia, raised in Russia, and later moved to the US. Along the way, I've also lived and studied in the Netherlands, where half of my family is from. While Iowa is and always will be home, there is a part of me that feels unrooted, a persistent longing for something deeper and more grounding, a sense of profound homeness. This feeling of being in between also shapes my professional and academic work. I'm a big picture thinker who is equally drawn to the intricacies, the mechanics behind how the big picture comes to life. Yet, I often feel out of sync with many of the spaces I occupy, particularly in affordable housing and community development, where the prevailing approaches can feel narrow or restrictive at times. Coming from a culture deeply rooted in collectivism, I find myself returning to this idea and what it means across the various worlds I navigate and how I can foster it. My work has been driven by a desire to advance collective sense-making and dismantle the limiting frameworks that shape how we understand and approach complex challenges. For me, it's been about finding ways to honor and connect with these diverse perspectives that I have encountered in my life in an effort to create spaces that feel whole, inclusive, and expansive, while also drawing me closer to being at home.
It's so fascinating on the question of home, right? I remember we kind of have conversations around that in our previous episodes. It's a fascinating question when we think about how do we make home in places or spaces that we inevitably find ourselves in and had no, I guess, no original intention to be in other than, I think, life circumstances. And that idea kind of has also in a way shape how I think about my work and where I want to go. Especially, I know you've kind of mentioned, I think, the sense of precariousness, right? Where really there's just so many instability that is kind of happening globally. And there is this, kind of ongoing sense of like, oh, the world is ending. Or like, I think, we're losing, a lot of people are losing trust in our humanity in some sense. And then it reminds me of a conversation with Carol Baldenkuze, I think, where we talk about that in a way. The questions around how in the future world where essentially, we're increasing climate migration, increasing potential of extreme climate events and displacements and due to, kind of climate disasters or wars and so on, we are going to find ourselves living next to strangers. How do we make kin with each other in a way, right? And it brings me to the idea of what bell hooks call radical love, where it's essentially, how do we love other as we love ourselves, which seems like a straightforward question. Like, how do we love other in a way that we want for them the same as we want for us, right? So then seems like a straightforward question, but at the same time, it really shakes our ideas of privileges and, who would benefit from a future where resources are getting much more scarce and where potentially there are going to be organizations or others who are able to kind of like hoard there's resources, and then we kind of increasingly find ourselves in kind of conflicts and tensions around who gets what and who and where, which is actually an ongoing questions, right? But then I think we can expect those questions to be more prominent in the future years. And it always feels like it's gloom and doom, which is why I feel like it's more for me really to think through those questions and to sit with grief. The idea of like, there's like ecological grief or maybe anxiety that I see a lot in my students in a way when I talk about environmental injustices. But at the same time, like we people who are engaged in the scholarship do need to sit down with our own grief and how do we like teach things or talk about things that it seems to be like there's hope, but then not really when you're like losing hope in so many different fronts. So.
I'm really glad that we have something that captures the grief that we're kind of processing and feeling around the injustices done to our natural environments, right? And to Mother Earth. I don't know if something, if a similar concept or understanding exists that captures the grief that comes from the built environment, right? The ways that the physical environments that we're in are constructed, and the kinds of grief and violence that is generated from the ways that we construct our physical environment. And that's an area that I explore specifically in my own research, my own current PhD research, where I'm looking at this notion of embedded place precarity, which I define as the layered, systemic, and persistent uncertainty and vulnerability that low-income households navigate, which threaten their physical presence and stability in their own homes, but then also their physical presence and stability in their own neighborhoods and the particular places that they have the social and communal connections and roots in.
Yeah, I think the constructed environment is definitely is a center, one of the centers in urban scholarship, right? In planning scholarship, which is, I think I'm looking forward to the opportunities to explore how emotions then can further recognize and integrate it into the work that planners, environmental and injustice advocates do through things like tools like storytelling as a decolonizing practice. I am like really hopeful in looking at the wave of scholars from the global south, and I think Eka, you've been kind of really engaged in a lot of those work where like how we think about planning and how we think about engaging with communities comes from the practice on the ground, right? Rather than from some of the canon or classic readings of people or outside scholars looking into. And, a lot of those scholars from the Global South practice planning as an organizing of hope, right? By using alternative knowledge, including stories of communities and of policies, or maybe of like collective policies, maybe not necessarily institutional policies that can inspire others to act.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, for the past year, I've been working or concentrating more into this creation of the new capital city, as you may know, Nusantara. Yeah. So Indonesia is currently building its new capital city in Borneo, in Kalimantan. Huge questions here is like, whose capital city is this? And who, I mean, like, what kind of capital city that they are creating? So basically, when you talk about the environmental justice or even like the bottom-up approach that I would always advocate, for instance, we all know that most of the capital cities are very heavily top-down. Yeah, it's a very heavily top-down policy planning. But then, if you like to create such an inclusive city, then my advocacy would be we need to include people on the ground. And that's why, if we look at the Nusantara, the name of the new capital city, there are a lot of things to be taken into account, not only about inclusion of the people who are on the ground in Kalimantan, but also about the urban biodiversity. Since we are going to build a massive city here, what happened to the urban biodiversity, for instance? Another thing is, the reason why Indonesia is creating or building this new capital is because the current capital city of Jakarta is literally sinking at rapid pace. So, if it is sinking, then another question is, what are we going to do with this sinking city? Jakarta is a house of 10 million people. And if it is sinking, what about the community who's living here for hundreds of years, right? So it's really significant to look at the most pressing challenges facing Indonesia, starting from the Jakarta's condition that is, sinking, but also the creation of the new capital that is actually not conforming the target, for instance, yeah, because initially they want 2024 as the first phase, and then this has to be used as the capital city. But as a matter of fact, the construction is still going on. Now, when we are talking about the movement of the capital, a lot of questions is also addressed, like, what about the Jakarta? Do they have any plan to rescue the sinking city? Although there are so many plans in order to rescue that, but at the moment it has become so political, and none of these plans were actually being executed, and the cities actually keep sinking. And even though we have this seawall that is actually protecting the city from the seawater, but the huge rate of land subsidence is actually making this wall becoming lower and lower, yeah. And the fact that a lot of politics is going on the ground, and none of the decision has been made in order to save the current sinking city. So it's really not fair for Jakarta people to suffer every time. As you know, that the northern part of Jakarta, 40% of it is actually below the sea level. So it's really alarming. But none of this has been taken into account so far. So I think that's something that really critical in terms of the social justice, in terms of the urban planning, urban design, where whenever we would like to create something new or any kind of approach, just making sure that everyone is included, everyone shouldn't be left behind. I think that's my note from this past year.
It seems like the question is now we're thinking about, when we think about past, present, and future, right? What I'm hearing from what you just kind of explained is that, I think it's really critical for all of us to think about future possibilities. But at the same time, right, how do we ensure, right, like all of those inclusion happen in the present, moving towards the future, right? In the places that we, I guess, in a way, people leave behind, but also in the place to the places that we want to kind of build. And I think that also, like, the past is really critical too, right? Because it does shape our understanding of maybe at the very least what has worked in the past, or what can we learn from our past mistakes?
Yeah, definitely. Like, for instance, if we are looking at the design of the new capital city, the Nusantara has been designed to be the opposite of Jakarta. I mean, in terms of planning, it was stated that it should be flood-proof, yeah, and it has a lot of water retention. It is a smart, sustainable city that is so unlike Jakarta. That is something, the ambition, yeah. But something that we need to learn as well from here is actually what happened to Jakarta shall not be repeated in the new capital. We had this development so concentrated in Jakarta that all this greater area, Jakarta greater metropolitan area, were kind of like being left behind. And then everyone is just coming to this new center, for instance, the Jakartas, yeah. So if we have the similar approach, learning from our mistake that happened to Jakarta, if we just concentrate on creating the center of the capital city in Kalimantan, the story will repeat by itself. So it will become very exclusive. It will attract people to come rather than having several spots surrounding the capital city. We have this two main cities in the new capital, right? We have Balikpapan, we also and that those areas needs to be developed as well equally in order to make sure that not everyone is just concentrating on the central. So I think you are right. I totally agree that we need to learn from the past, and so that we are not going to repeat the mistake that we did in the past.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm getting from what you shared earlier, this sense of the need to kind of like really think about our own positions, right? And how that position shape our work related to the constructed environment around planning or even kind of policy. I'm doing that a lot for, in terms of like thinking about how I grieve and how opportunities that I, how I, and around my need to seek communities and spaces where I actually can do the work of like mourning, right? Because it seems like, from Eka's description around like all the work that's going on, even if we're like building something new, you know, that something new is going to replace something that was already there, right? So some in that place, there was already existing communities, existing ecosystem, biodiversity, and that's a loss in a way, right?
I think for me, it's an instinctual kind of inner practice for me in the ways that I naturally like interrogate the ways that my own positionality, my own past lived experiences shape the ways that I connect with other people, and the ways that I approach my work as a student and also as a professional and an advocate. But I think it's not, I find myself taking it for granted at times when when I get frustrated, when I'm not as successful getting other people to see things that they should be seeing,
Yeah,
right?
I get that. Yeah.
So for a while now, I've been trying to kind of take a step back and think about, okay, well, this is an instinctual act for me, but perhaps it doesn't come as easy to other people, right? Particularly people in decision-making spaces, right, that have power and influence and in a capacity to be able to either mobilize or manage public or private resources that then affect the ways that people live their lives in the real world. So I've been trying to be more compassionate and patient. I've also been exploring ways that I can facilitate empathy and support others in getting comfortable in interrogating their own positionality and how that shapes their approach to their work, right? I'm still in the exploration phase. I think I've been leaning into storytelling a lot. I found comfort there, and as I explore this further, and documentary filmmaking specifically is what I've been exploring as a mechanism for fostering empathy in others, but then a particular type of empathy, right? An empathy that requires the other or invites the other person, or perhaps it's an institution or a governing body that invites the other to interrogate themselves and how they're coming into a particular place.
Well, bearing witness is one of the things that people do, right? To, in a way, catalog experiences and tell truths, you know, amongst all the competing truths. And storytelling is one of that, you know, kind of short, you know, film documentaries is a great example of that, where you are illustrating, you know, kind of stories that doesn't always get told from the dominant perspective. I think the challenge for me has always been making that connections between, you know, like when you talk about narratives or storytelling in particular, it's a very powerful policy tool, but it and also kind of connecting to decision making is like a really, really complicated question, a big gap, right? And in, how do you then translate that into actions, right? Like, I think we see that a lot in like politics in the US in particular, and maybe worldwide, how, you know, say in the questions of in Palestine, how there is so much activism, so much voices in terms of like wanting governments to do, you know, to do what is right, to recognize Palestinian human rights. But at the same time, how that translates into policy making or decision making is so challenging. It's not always aligned. And that's just kind of one example from many, many things and realities. And in the US in particular, we're, you know, kind of going to inaugurate a new president, right? With a lot of very controversial takes on a lot of issues. And so there's the anxiety part certainly is kind of plays a role. So I guess I would like to, you know, to throw out the questions there, right? In terms of thinking about And this is also a big question in planning, right? In things in terms of translating between what we know or knowledge or collective knowledge production towards like collective action. What do you think, right? What would it take? Or what are some of the themes that you've noticed in terms of like if you were to face that question? That might be related to what's new challenges or opportunities that you're excited to explore in the future. Well, I think at least for me, I've started to shift my focus in terms of generations, right? Like at least maybe I'm asking similar questions, right? How do we get from like knowledge and critical inquiries or thinking about spaces, but direct those questions towards more of our younger generations? And which is kind of like the essence of Walk My Bricks project, which is really to get our younger people to think about where they are in the spaces and, and their relationship to their environment. And once I understood that, once they understood kind of like the present, the past, present, and future possibilities, can they then kind of engage in the multiple acts of kind of transformation? I'm reading Paulo Freire. And he has a book called Pedagogy of the Oppressed. It's about kind of like how do we engage into dialogue, and maybe I'm simplifying it too much, but thinking about that critical transformations that need to happen for some people or individuals to move from like, okay, I get this. I get this. I understand, but now I want to do something about it and act. Because that's the big gap that I'm like, I face so many times in so many different situations where, like, yes, I sympathize with this. I get this. I get that it's not right. I get that there's injustice happening, but no action, right? As if empathy is enough, which is empathy is a great place to start. But what do we need to do to build on our future possibilities that are, just and sustainable and, inclusive for everyone?
Empathy is the starting place and the heart space that we lead with, but I think it's definitely not enough. As I mentioned earlier, I've been leaning into storytelling and reflecting on ways that narrative and language can support the work that I do and the ways that I would like to make an impact through my research and practice. There are two scholars whose work I've been reading a lot in the last several months. One is Dr. Faranak Midavtab of University of Chicago, Urbana-Champaign, urban scholar and theorist. Another is Dr. Yuria Selidwin, who is a senior fellow at the Othering and Belonging Institute at UC Berkeley. I recently picked up her book, Flourishing Kin: Indigenous Wisdom for Collective Well-being. And I'm only two chapters into it, but the words and the writing in this book are so powerful. And I'm finding ways of expression in this book that I have been looking for, that I personally have been struggling to express on my own, but reading it so far has brought a sense of comfort, in knowing that there are words for expressing what I'm feeling and what I'm trying to understand in the world. So I want to read a brief excerpt from the introduction chapter of this book that I think is prevalent to the conversation that we're having today. Flourishing is a gradual unfolding of aesthetic arrest, a succession of awe-induced palpitations of stillness of the mind and embodied effervescence. Flourishing brings the realization of belonging and thus manifests reverence for life and the pursuit of creative action for the well-being of the planetary community. In its many forms, contemplative practice opens these strings of progress as we wander through trails of intentional experience. Attentive presence unleashes varieties of transformation and spiritual experiences through these trails. While the paths may seem daunting, messy, or overgrown, the practice both grounds and lightens us, and the journey opens us to transcend our limitations of identity. These limitations are the labels about ourselves and others that we have become reified, so thick they make us stuck. We have forgotten that we once created these identity stories, and because of their very nature, they can be retold to set us free. So that beautiful excerpt from Dr. Seligwin's recently published book, Flourishing Kin, is incredibly powerful and relevant to our conversation today, but then also I think the ways that we approach our collective work and our efforts to make sense together and find ways that we can deconstruct our past to understand the ways that our present has been created so we can find and explore different ways of creating a future that is limitless, right? That kind of leans into possibility and potential in ways that also embrace uncertainty and unknowing, right? I think so much of the work of planning as an institution is about creating certainty, right? It's about creating something that we know to be the best, from our position today. And I think there's not enough room in the visioning process, in the actual materialization phase of how we approach development that kind of takes into consideration and embraces a level of uncertainty and unknowing that then puts us in a position, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, to comfortably question what we have done in a way that would make us comfortable to undo certain things that need to be undone. Things that have put us in a place where we've caused harm to others, not only humans, but also to Mother Nature, right? To our ecology.
Yeah, I think as an indigenous scholar, Dr. Seligwin and other scholars, including Black scholars, I believe, kind of like Ruha Benjamin talks about vital justice. How do we grow the world we want? How do we, kind of imagine or envision future possibilities? And this is not like part of our plan, but I recently listened to someone who was teaching about rhetorics and the power of words or terminologies within our law system, right? Our constitutional system. Just how some words like, say, democracy, rights, freedom is not just words. They're like so powerful that how those apply to different people have been discussed by scholars of law or founding fathers or, in whatever countries and say like, what kind of freedom do we want to have? What rights should, this group of people have versus this group of people? And, contrast and kind of this Jim Crow was like, kind of a big history of the United States and redlining. And those are examples of law that have been inscribed, constructed, as what was kind of illustrated. And those were examples of law that has been dismantled because we have, as a society, agreed that it's not the world that we want to live in, right? And so that there's just that action step that I think maybe the work now is about imagining. We're not there yet to like actually build something new. So like the capital city is still in the imagination process, maybe, Eka, because as much as maybe the Indonesian government have started building things there, I don't think the idea of a whole new capital city have entered the minds or like public realm amongst majority of Indonesians, right? Or not even being discussed in their everyday life.
Yeah, I mean, there are some pros and cons regarding the new capital, of course, and that is very natural. But the fact that, I mean, the good thing is Now we concentrate on the island other than Java. I mean, that's a very good thing. But of course, there will be also another controversial things. If we don't do this properly, then it will become like a disaster rather than creating a good thing for, Indonesian people. So I think reflecting back to what you mentioned about what can we do about this, So it's really, frustrating. We as scholars, we are very trained to analyze the situation. But when it comes to a solution, what can we do about it? And that's a big hurdle. And I think our unique proposition here is that all of us are very much kind of like into the work that we will do to give an impact either to the community, either to the government, or to the general public. For instance, we've done this research, right, Dian, when we had to kind of like install the biopores, in order to make sure that the water gets in back to the soil. It looks like a very small project, but it actually has a huge impact in terms of the community cohesion, in terms of the ways in which we change the perspective of making sure that we look after our planet, for instance. Or another work that that I've been doing, I've been giving some kind of professional expert interviews about this capital city, which in the end it has been heard by the government and they kind of like incorporate that into the planning law, for instance. So I think the matters of looking at this discourse of, all this injustice or kind of like not being discussed in public, I think it's time for us to step forward to kind of like do what we can, even though maybe it looks a little bit small, but it's been impactful. And I know, Amal, you've been doing such a great work as well, and now you're doing the film. So I think that is also very impactful. And I think we need to celebrate even of every a little thing that we've done, because that has brought some impacts to the community, to the government, and to the general public. I think, I really like that kind of idea of giving impact.
I appreciate what you said about like celebrating, the process, right? And it reminded me of someone who kind of does research into her own communities and like trying to acknowledge joy in the process of engaging communities that are oppressed or have been traditionally marginalized. And saying how, I really don't want to postpone joy for my community, right? Like it's important to celebrate and to appreciate the joy that we have, although on kind of like a broader framing network, the task of making a change can be daunting, right? And it reminds me of like, the idea of resilience, of how it's not just about bouncing back or being able to have access to basic necessities, but also to be able to find joy in every little thing, kind of and celebrate the progress, right? I think that's probably the best, one of the best ways to kind of say it. Because a lot of the big changes that we've seen in the society, at least in the US, and we think about revolution, right? Civil rights movement, end of slavery, that doesn't happen within a person's lifetime, right? That's people who kind of like really engage in the struggle doesn't always get to see the outcome. But it's really critical to be part of that. And that's, I think, also one of the things that I've been trying to highlight to my students in a way. it's great that you think about like what you would like the outcomes to be, but at the same time, like how are you engaging in the process toward that outcome?
I love what you said about not postponing joy. I think that's something that I personally struggle with, I have to admit. Particularly in the space that I'm in, in housing, I think it's hard not to bear witness to how we're going about the housing crisis wrong. It shouldn't be a privilege, right? I mean, having a home to call yours, having a place to go home to at the end of the day where you feel safe and warm and a sense of comfort and safety, that should not be a privilege. That's a right that everyone should have. But it's hard not to walk out of the front door of your home and not see all of the ways that your community is hurting. So for me, it's something that I see, and it's hard for me not to see it and to bear witness to it every day when I'm out, and also even when I don't leave my home. And as a result, I oftentimes find myself feeling hopeless, feeling frustrated and angry, and leaning towards pessimism. So as a result, I find myself delaying joy, right? When it comes to this work, it's like, well, what is there to be joyful about when the pain is still very present and ever so increasing, right? The number of households that are navigating various levels of crises, of instability, economic instability and housing instability, it's ever so increasing, particularly in the US. So it's like, I haven't done enough to be joyful right now. I need to wait until I feel like I have done enough to contribute towards making things better before I can celebrate, before I can be joyful. But I think in delaying the joy, I end up feeling exhausted, right, and defeated very, very frequently. And that's also not sustainable on a personal level, right? You end up, turning away a lot of times when certain kinds of conversations or partnerships don't go or don't evolve at a pace where you would like them to evolve, right? To be able to generate a certain level of impact. So I think it's a challenge and a task that I want to embrace in an effort to secure my own survival and health and well-being. I think joy cannot be delayed any longer.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because you somehow, in a way, is reflecting towards like your individual joy, right? And I think this is kind of like a wider conversation that's happening in terms of recognizing the validity of rage as kind of like it's a valid emotion. We should be enraged about all of those, a lot of the injustices that we see locally and globally. But it's not an emotion that is often acknowledged or seen as like valid in a lot of policy discussion, right? Whereas if you're in reality, kind of like being able to act upon that rage in a way that channels towards like collective liberation is so critical because then you also think about collective joy, right? How and then collective joy brings community together. How do we, right, not just individual, but as a community, as part of any members of the community, come back to that idea that, as a community, we can kind of maybe celebrate our little wins, no matter, kind of if you are able, say, to, assist a family who's struggling to find a temporary home even, right? That's a collective win, right? It's like it's and so not necessarily patting ourselves in the back that you've done, oh, good job, right? But it's an acknowledgement that, maybe the way forward is to like to build upon, like this wave or little momentum or recognize like the butterfly effects of things and recognize that in a world that is so precarious, we don't know what efforts could lead to positive outcomes. And I think, Eka, you talk about this in the policy about like, oh, I'm really spending so much time doing interviews and talking about what the policy or the practice around planning a new home, new capital city should be. But then, who knows, at the other side of it, someone who do makes decision could be the one who picked up on those things and implement them, right? And that's out of our control. So like maybe just like letting go of like the things that we can control is the first thing to do. And so that in order for you to like, for all of us to recognize that there are little wins or joys that, it's healthy to appreciate them, although we recognize the big task ahead.
The next conversation we have should be dedicated to joy
We should find someone who's
and letting
loved.
go of control, right?
The main thing is we really need to appreciate what we've done, even though maybe it doesn't look glorious as others. But for me, maybe also for you, as a female with a lot of baggage behind, at the back, me as a mother, two kids, traveling to three countries in a year and still maintaining your duty as a mom, as a wife. It's incredible, isn't it? And sometimes we just forgot. And then we always compare ourselves to others who, getting a lot of promotions, for instance, this year. But actually, if we even survive this year, that is actually an achievement. I think that is something that, I also often tend to forget. Oh, I've come so far and I've done this and that, but it's never been enough, right? I mean, if we keep comparing ourselves to others, and I think this is the time for us, even, back to celebrating a little joy, a little achievement, which perhaps not only we see that as sometimes not important, but maybe other people might see that as not important, but it is actually important, And coming so far, it's very a big achievement. I think that's how I feel it and how I reflect this year, despite ups and downs, of course. Sometimes you cry, sometimes you laugh, sometimes you feel joy, sometimes you feel sadness. But here we are by the end of the year, December 2024. We are still standing, we are still working, and we are still doing our job and do our best. So, yeah, that's how I see this. Optimism, maybe another word.
I love that.
Yeah. And I think it allows us to like celebrate values of each other, right? I appreciate and celebrate you, Eka, kind of overcoming all those challenges and kind of, Amal, with having to travel back and forth, caretaking and families and so many different ways. And so that is in itself is like an achievement, and we do often forget about that.
I would love to, and I'm surprised that I haven't had this conversation with you, Eka, yet. As someone who spent more years kind of navigating living life and maintaining life in multiple geographies, very different geographies, right, with significant time zone differences. And for me, being someone who's newer at figuring that out now, I'm surprised. So I haven't had this conversation with you personally and kind of getting your insights on how I can be better prepared for it. So I would love to talk more about this particular topic at a later date, but tell us kind of your current home base situation and what are some of the things that you've been doing to kind of help you maintain balance and stability as you move around these different geographies?
Well, I must say this is not a very easy journey. I've been doing this for the past 3 years. As I mentioned, it's been ups and downs. When you have to leave your kids, for instance, and that's when you feel like you fail as a mom, Sometimes you have that kind of feeling. But then when you are there and then you have to work, and then you have to leave again. So it's a kind of like and you also feel like, oh, you fail as an employee, for instance. So that's kind of mixed feeling that I got. But to be honest, we start these kind of things with the commitment. Commitment from my side, from the company side. And then from that commitment, we try to find a way to make it work at the best convenient. Of course, there is no such a perfect ideal situation. But I think what I'll do when I'm there in a different country, then I will be there and put my concentration 100% to be there, be present. And when I'm here, then I'll be 100% concentrating on that. Although I must say a lot of sacrifice that I also do. For instance, when I am here with my family, because my family is based here in Europe, then I still have to do a lot of work as well, right? For the job that I have in Asia. So what I'll do is if there is a meeting even at 2 a.m., 3 a.m., then because of this commitment, then I'll be there. I'll be turning up. And certain KPIs that needs to be delivered, even when I am not physically in Asia, I have to deliver. So the same thing when I am in Asia, then my responsibility as a mom, that doesn't cease. So what I did was, even though it may look weird, like I have to wake up like 2 a.m., right? You know, to make sure that I make a phone call with my kids, or call them, for instance, during the midday, just to make sure that they wake up for school, or having a conversation with them just before they went to bed. That kind of things, it looks so difficult because of the time differences. And sometimes you're also in the middle of something because of that time differences. But I think we managed to work it out. And so far, I know that it's not being smooth all the time, but at least it's working. And we put a lot of respect to each other, to my part, my family, and also to my employers, for instance. So it's a kind of like communication is the key. You have to communicate that, even though quite often it doesn't work 100% efficient. But I think we just have to work it out, to find a way rather than focusing on the problems and just blaming the situation. My advice would be, what are the ways that we can, you know, get away with it? You know, we can kind of like resolve the problem rather than concentrating on or blaming the situation. Because working in two or three different countries, it's a huge commitment, and it's a lot of work and a lot of sacrifice. I think that's my tips, Amma.
For context to our listeners, Eka splits her time between Indonesia and Germany. And you also spent some time in Australia too, right?
Yeah, so that's how three time zones. Sometimes I get confused. What time is it in here? And so on. Yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us, Eka. I think this is a great segue into wrapping up our conversation today.
You're
Before
welcome.
we do that, maybe we can just share briefly some what challenges or opportunities we're excited to explore in the coming months.
Oh, I
Dion?
mean, I'm just excited for more opportunities to read a lot. Plunging into the literatures. I hope to engage in kind of methodologies rooted in the thinking, writing, and imagining of Black and Brown bodies using a range of texts, disciplines, and histories to construct our own narratives in planning and policy. I'm increasingly kind of thinking about, you know, including those conversations around infrastructural justice as central to a lot of the environmental justice, climate justice conversations that I'm engaged in at the Sustainability Department. Personally, I took some writing class this semester because
Creative writing, right?
it's a non-fiction
Okay.
writing, but one of the techniques that the professor had was like doing a memory bank of like capturing what memories show up for you throughout the different years of your life for however much that you want. So like it was just kind of that exercise was so gold because it helped me to understand like, okay, this is where like how I understand issues around flooding and resilience came up because I experienced it as a 20-something year old in my own parents' home, right? And so that, and it helps me to like really think through those things, but also write about it and be able to like further situate and integrate my positionality into my scholarship and pedagogical approaches.
So I'm currently in Des Moines, sitting next to Dion at Drake University. So I'm going to be here for a while before returning back to Amsterdam. So I'm really excited about what possibilities that's going to bring to me, and what kinds of collaborative opportunities that's going to that are going to show up as a result of me being here for the next several months in Des Moines, which is home for me. And I'm also excited about potential collaborations with you, Dion, in the spring semester. Outside of that, so in 2023, I launched a project called Walking in Place, which is a film and community archival research initiative that's connected to my PhD work, but I use film, documentary filmmaking and historic GIS tools to be able to reconstruct lost landscapes. We released a film, a short documentary film in the summer of 2023, and my film partner and I are working on a second short film project, a series of mini short films. So we're going to start filming in the next few weeks. So I'm very excited about kind of how that creative process is going to evolve as we complete these short film projects. And what kinds of opportunities it's going to present in terms of further integrating collaborative storytelling and narrative production into my PhD research.
For me, I think the next part that I will do is I have to kind of like seize this opportunity to publish more and write more. And I think this is the time for us to shine. So it's time for us to kind of like, all right, we've done a lot, and I think we should sit down and as Dian did, took a writing class. And I think this is a good chance for us to kind of like expose ourselves. Because I think for scholars in the global south, we are very has a little exposure on our work. And I think the only way of doing it is just through publication. So my plan is to publish more, hopefully next year.
We're excited to be there with you on that journey. Well, I think this is a wrap for us. Until next time, remember, together we can make a difference and create sustainable, equitable, and thriving communities for all. Thanks for listening, and until next time, this is Eka Permanasari, Dian Nostakasari, and Amal Bare signing off.